trying to pass through the small arms envelope to an on-the-deck condition where we were flying as literally as low as we could fly without knocking things down or running into things for a short distance, and then pop up to spray altitude, 100 to 150 feet. This, depending on the approach to the target or the approaches available to the target, was utilized on occasion. The difficulty with it is that its navigation, visual navigation at that extreme low altitude is difficult, and if that on the deck leg was too long in distance, it was too easy to get disoriented and get lost on the final run-in. However, there is, through study of the photographs and study of the map, it was sometimes possible to employ a final entry onto a target area utilizing a low-level run-in on the deck run-in. The object behind that was to be down as low as possible, and as a result, it makes it difficult for someone with a small arms with a rifle or a light machine gun or submachine gun to swing because of intervening objects. It might be trees, bushes, or whatnot that obstruct his field of fire. And this was used, method was used on occasion. Again, with the fighters and the escort aircraft being held back behind the approach so that they wouldn't be heard or seen and be an alerting factor to something that might be going on. I might, Paul, at this time just kind of talk about how a target evolved during the time frame in which I was there. Once the Vietnamese district and provincial leaders were made aware that this tool was available to them, i.e. defoliation and or crop destruction, they, along with their army counterparts in the field, would discuss the merits of pro and con of spraying a particular area. At the local level, if it was decided through the province or district commander that to spray area A would have beneficial effects, that request was made to the appropriate officials in Saigon with their American counterparts. If they agreed that a particular area was beneficial to spray, the area then, through the Army USAF, or American Army counterpart, they would come out to the ranch headquarters and say, hey, can we go up and survey this particular area? We think it has merit to spray. We want you to take a look at it to see if it's reasonably easy to work or workable, and if so, to give you a view of it from altitude, from a high altitude, 4,000 or 5,000 feet, where you were, fly around, take a look at it, and familiarize ourselves with it. Usually one of the pilots that would be flying the mission and one of the navigators. Once MACV with the Vietnamese counterparts approved a particular area to be sprayed, that area was given to us, and we ranch hand people broke it down into flyable segments, if you will, and that information was taken to what was at that time 2nd ADVON and 2nd Air Division, later to become 7th Air Force. We would end up taking the target package to 7th Air Force, or 2nd ADVON, later to become 7th, and say, all right, this is what we're going to do. This is when we're going to do it. Will you guys frag the fighter support this is what we think we need, and this is what we think we need in terms of helicopter support, rescue helicopter support. And they in turn would lay those requirements on to the fighters at Benoit or wherever the fighters might be coming out of. So that we, during the period of time where I was there, we were very much involved in actually the selection and setting up the time frame and the calendar for the spraying of a particular area. And the commander of the ranch, whoever he might be at the time, worked quite closely with the people at 2nd ADVON or 7th Air Force to make sure that we were relatively random as much as possible, as much as target selection would allow, so we wouldn't be flying into the same area day after day after day. Throughout the early years, as the Arvin became aware of the capability that was available to him and their U.S. Army counterparts become more and more aware of it, of course the additional sorties and requests for targets grew as time went along. The coordination missions were kind of fun. It allowed us to get out into, we'd fly our own airplanes and go out and, you know, land at some of the smaller strips and allowed us to get around the country, meet with some of the provincial officials. Usually as an air crew, that portion of it face to face, we didn't get too much involved. It was more or less of a sit and listen type of, more mainly between the Army Chemical Corps liaison people and the their counterparts in the field. The aerial surveys were helpful, particularly to the pilots and also to the air crew. It allowed us to look at the area, get an eyeball on it from altitude, cross-reference to the charts, sometimes photographs. Sometimes we would request that an area that we get aerial photographs to allow us to study the area in more detail. But the airborne survey, I thought, was always helpful. And the survey, normally we'd survey an area and probably wouldn't go back and spray it maybe a month or 2 months later, so there was no problem with our presence, you know, affecting. They just saw this airplane circling, and someone on the ground would just see an airplane circling around and at high altitude and with nothing transpiring, and so it didn't really affect the element of surprise to any degree. One other aspect that was interesting to work, or one other mission that was interesting to work, was the initial spraying of what generally was called the Ho Chi Minh Trail. The road network system had extended down the eastern ridges or reaches of Laos. During the 64 time frame was still in its embryonic stages south of Highway 9, which is the east-west highway that runs from Quezon across through Chepon and comes out at Savannakhet in Laos. South of that, in the 64 time frame, the area was under surveillance by American FACs flying out of Kontum and flying out of Benoit. And, of course, it was under surveillance by recce aircraft. But much of the heavy vehicular traffic had already transshipped a lot of the materials, food and ammunition and so forth, and were being hand-carried east into South Vietnam, over literally a foot trail network. Our initial work over there was to open up or to spray these areas where the road was either poorly defined or heavily covered because it hadn't had enough utilization to really get it burned in. On the avenues and up through the canyons and so forth of the trail network, as it extended from the major north-south artery eastward into the and up over the ridges into South Vietnam proper, our survey flights in that area helped to expand the added to the expansion of the knowledge of the trail. And at that time, the trail pretty much petered out on a east-west line running through Kontum, which in later years, of course, 65, 6, 7, and 8, and on in even later, why the trail was much more well-defined, and the vehicular traffic extended all the way to the Cambodian border and beyond. But it was in the early times when flying out there was kind of interesting. The North Vietnamese were extremely well disciplined in that in the daytime you could fly that area at relatively low altitude, and you would never receive any ground fire at all. It was kind of an eerie feeling. You knew you were being watched. But their mission at that time was not to shoot down airplanes, but was simply to move logistics down that pipeline southward and not get into a fracas with airplanes. I did an evaluation of some of the ranch work in midwinter of 64-65 and flew quite a few sorties along that segment of the trail in an 01 aircraft, just buzzing along at 150, 200, 300 feet, just observing, looking at bomb craters and how fast it took them to be filled in, and never received any ground fire at all. And it was only because of their mission was to move logistics, and it was not to shoot at airplanes, and they didn't want any more attention brought to themselves than they were already receiving. Of course, that changed in the later 60s when they started defending the trail to a greater degree, particularly in the daytime. But a lot of the initial work that we did there did opened up visibility substantially to vertical surveillance as a result of the spraying of the herbicides. Those missions did become fairly dangerous. The opposition increased significantly after about 1966. And one aircraft was lost in the neighborhood of Highway 9 and the main north-south artery of the trail itself. It's not known for sure whether it was due to ground fire. The 123, of course, being as simple of an aircraft as it is, lacking any complicated hydraulic or electrical systems, why it pretty much makes it an ideal aircraft to do that kind of work, as long as you're dealing with primarily a small arms environment. When you start talking in terms of heavier opposition, such as quad 50s and what's normally considered AAA or AA, why then, of course, the airplane starts to become more susceptible to severe damage. But I think that the fact that so few airplanes were actually lost to ground fire says quite a lot for how a simple airplane, lacking complex hydraulics and electronics and so forth, can survive in a small arms envelope or in a small arms where the threat is only from relatively small arms. Occasionally, I've been asked, and it was a question that we asked ourselves a lot during the period of time while I was there. It's just really how effective the herbicide program was. The most generally, I'd have to say that the most productive result was resulted from the crop destruction. Although we'll never know exactly how much that program, how much additional burden it placed on the logistics system of the Viet Cong, I think it goes without question that that particular segment of the work was probably put increasing burden on the enemy, inasmuch as it forced them to seek other areas, it forced them to put or assign additional manpower to the logistics system to make up for the crop loss that occurred as a result of our work. A lot of the area, the large acreage, the big, large-scale areas that we sprayed, big open jungle areas, quite often the results there, at least to the eye, and the increase in vertical visibility was often quite disappointing, if, in fact, in my view, fairly unproductive. There are many large areas, zone, War Zone D, which is the first one we got heavily involved in, that where the jungle was so dense and the cover so complete that even though the top canopy was stripped, you saw very little increase in vertical visibility from the eye, you know, from the eyeball. Whether photo reconnaissance was enhanced, I have never seen a case made, yes or no, for that. But many cases you'd fly over an area which you'd sprayed, and you could see the results of your spray in as much as there was a discoloration in the foliage. But you saw no appreciable increase in vertical visibility. One explanation we were given, of course, was that when the older, taller trees may have been killed, that the sunlight then being allowed to reach the lower foliage allowed that growth to accelerate, and that would, of course, obscure the ground, which was what you were trying to get a better view of. So I think a lot of the large area defoliation, where we go in and do very large area spraying, was probably less productive than even would have warranted the cost. Lines of communication, and they seem to be have more value. We did quite a bit along the railway lines, going up Highway 1, going up the coast of the country, and I could see where that could be quite helpful. A lot of canals were covered along the side. The canals were opened up, and I can see where this would be helpful as far as removing some of the cover that could be utilized by an ambush team. Another area that I thought was fairly productive was vegetation control around special forces camps, whereby the field of fire could be from the camp outward, towards the outward perimeter and beyond, could be by controlling the vegetation in these areas, why it could aid in reducing the camp's vulnerability to attack, at least from the infantry. It could still wouldn't negate mortar or long distance artillery or anything like that, but it would certainly allow the defenders a better field of fire. I always thought that was pretty probably pretty decent work. Of course, Ashaw is a good example. Ashaw was finally lost, but had it not been sprayed, at all, who is to say whether it might not have fallen earlier? And it was sprayed on a number of occasions around the camp perimeter, as were other places. But I think in the area of crop denial, I think is where the operation ultimately made its best money, although we'll never know exactly how much additional burden we placed on the Viet Cong's logistics system as a result of it. Paul, while I'm thinking about it, I'm gonna send you a document that I don't have any idea who or how many copies there were. It was written by Lieutenant George Adams, and it's a history of Operation Ranch Hand through approximately the early years through 1965. I don't know how many copies of this are available. Some of the material that was in that history was utilized in one or two other documents that I've seen. It was not an official history. It doesn't have any official title. And it doesn't bear George's name, but I'm pretty sure George was the author of it. And it might be helpful to you. It also gives some detachment commanders' names who followed Carl Marshall, the original commander. And it also lists some tours that some of us from this, who later became PCS, the Special Aerial Spray Flight, served. You can see how our rotation schedule went. This document's got has been stamped secret all over it, but it's it's not a secret document. It was never annotated in the proper way that a secret document has to be or had to be. But it does have a bunch of secret stamps all over it. In fact, it's on each page, but I don't see any problem with that. I've had the thing since I don't know how long, for years and years and years. But it could be helpful in providing some additional information concerning the earlier, the earlier period of time. The stuff that I've, what information I've given you here in these tapes, I didn't go back through it to try to recall anything, so much of my meandering probably find that history as helpful as anything else. And I'll send that along to you, along with the return of these tapes. Of the tactics, I'd just like to make one comment about those earlier dates. In this package, you'll see the history, the one that George Adams wrote. Those dates, that document is circa 1964, as I recall. And the deployment dates are much more accurate, I'm sure. The information from that, the enclosed early history by George that I sent you a copy of. And I would like that copy back. You can bring it with you when you come down for the reunion on the 14th. Okay, concerning the tactics, the difficulty with a high-speed descent to an on-the-deck situation was that once you leveled out on deck, your range and visibility was so limited that navigation became a problem. This tactic was usually utilized to get through an area that was relatively densely populated. We're not talking about going through cities and towns, but areas where there is a lot of individual huts, individual farmers' houses. And we felt that if we could get down low, again early in the morning, low on the deck, and that leg was normally arranged in such an area that it went through the least populated area, and generally in a straight line, as much as you simply didn't have the range and visibility, and navigation was all but impossible, and if you didn't hit an initial IP perfectly on the desired heading, when it came time to pop up, you'd pop up and you were either totally lost or you weren't where you were supposed to be, and it was easy to get disoriented. But depending on the layout of the target way, sometimes that particular tactic was employed. It's interesting to note that we did fly one mission. We attempted to fly a canal mission at night. This was done, as I recall, in 63, without the use of flares. The aircraft, there was two airplanes in the formation. The airplanes drew ground fire, and as a result of, after it was decided that due to visibility restrictions and applicability, and as it would only be applicable, say, alongside of a canal where you could operate easily enough at night, why that, and then also evaluating or determining the fact that SAR, search and rescue recovery, if it was needed, would be extremely difficult. It was determined not to continue with experimenting with that, trying to operate at night, and when you look at it in practical terms, why the whole idea was ridiculous from the start, though it didn't go very far. Well, at the present time, I'm scratching my head for anything else I think you might be interested in, and I'll take this opportunity to apologize for being so slow getting this information to you. I've been extremely busy with an extremely busy season of chartering, and of course getting the newsletters out and managing a snack shop and this type of thing, so I've just been pretty well strapped for time, and I do apologize. There's no excuse, but I do apologize for the delay. I hope this material, the new address list, this list is all in the computer now and automatically printed and updated by us, but we don't have to do the manual labor on hand addressing the envelopes. And this takes quite a bit of burden because we're talking about 800 people on the mailing list. Again, I apologize for the delay, and I hope this material will help get you off the ground. My house is getting cluttered with a huge volume of clippings and so forth. So when you get down here in October, I could, as much as I'd like to keep it, I don't really need it. I've collected it over the years, and if you'd be interested in it, I'd just like to box it up, and when you go back to A&M, if you're interested, I'd certainly like, I could use the additional space here in the house. So we can talk about this when you get on down. Without any further ado, after you've listened to this, which I admit isn't a whole hell of a lot, make some questions or write down some questions of additional things you might want to ask of me. One of the tapes, tape number one, you'll see is torn. And I don't know how to fix them. I'm returning it to you so that maybe one of the tape shops down there might be able to square it away. My machine ate it for some reason when I first got it going. Look forward to seeing you in October. Again, apologize for the delay. To the ranch, buddy. Talk to you later.